Welcome to the full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:27 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is August 10th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, there used to be a time, not so long ago, that August was pretty uneventful. Everyone went off on vacation and didn't really worry about anything until they came back to their desks in September. Well, the world has moved on since then. That's certainly been the case for the last few years. Well, there are a lot of machinations going on, and certainly I don't think we could escape talking about Turkey in here today. But what I'd like to kick off with is this graphic from Haver Analytics. It's taking in data from the EIA, the US Census Bureau, Goldman Sachs as well. And there's this solid prediction that the US economy could be broadly energy independent sometime in 2019 and for petroleum sometime in 2021. Well, the USA spends or sends, that's I think probably a much better word, sends approximately $300 billion a year overseas in return for energy resources. And there's the realistic possibility, and it's something that we've been talking about for over a decade, that shale oil and gas would be a game changer for the energy sector. Well, the full ramifications of that continue to unfold. It's not simply that the USA has gone from being the biggest consumer to being the biggest importer, to being a net exporter in the space of a decade, but that is reshaping international relationships. That part of the reason why you have had a meltdown in terms of the political stability of the Middle East is in part because of population growth and because of the inability of governments that have been stratified for long periods of time to deal with the pressures that come from large young populations that need a source of income and demand higher standards of living. Well, I think that is an object lesson, because when we look at these highly totalitarian regimes, they can appear to be very strong, they can appear to be have very clear attributes, such as, for example, with China saying that look at the infrastructure that they can produce and their ability from central planning has been able to raise hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And that's certainly true. And then you have the coming from China, you have a steady stream of propaganda that democracy is outmoded, that it is ineffectual, that all it does is lock people into a cycle of debt. And there is a certain amount of truth to that as well. But there is one key strength to democracy in that it can change. And that by giving people a say and a right to self-determination, that we have ample evidence, if we choose to look for it, that democracy can, in fact, change and it can reform. But totalitarian regimes can't. That's the clear example we have from history. It's that when a totalitarian regime eventually breaks, well, then chaos ensues, and then the question is what follows it. Well, then it's really a crapshoot. There is no real consistent answer to that question. Now, the fact that the USA is going to be a net energy exporter gives it a rather clear difference of opinion with a large number of trading partners. Well, one thing, and I will return to looking at the Turkish situation, but I really would like to preface it in terms of the governance discussion. But one thing we can say for sure is that oil prices do tend to have these big bull markets that are followed by very lengthy ranges. And rather than being a consumer, there is the realistic possibility that the USA now has a vested interest in somewhat higher prices. Well, on a monthly basis, we have ample evidence that the oil price tends to go sideways for a long time, then it has these big bull markets and goes sideways. And we had a very, very big bull market, and now we're going sideways. And the amplitude of that range is between $35 and $120. And that's a very substantial range, but it is a range nonetheless. Now, there is always this big question about all the debt that's been has been accrued, not just in the USA but globally, and then on top of that, the additional debt that was taken out as a result of quantitative easing, and the fact that you have such a large number of privately held companies now that have not had to go to the stock market because they've been able to get ample sources of funds from both private equity and debt markets. So that has increased the leverage. And we also know that leverage has increased because the supply of Covlite loans has been trending higher. But it's been particularly trending higher in Europe since 2012. And in 2018, the Eurozone, or excuse me, Europe will issue more Covlite loans than the USA. I think that this is really telling us that there are some severe questions that need to be asked about the integrity of the European project. Not because, and not, well, let's be honest, not only because of the questions r surrounding the political infrastructure, but because of the debt environment and who exactly is going to pay these debts. When we look at the Italian stock market, it's not a bullish chart. I think if we simply look at this over the last decade, we are presented with a range. We're at the upper side of the range and the price has failed. The moving average has turned downwards. It is distributing below the trend mean and it moved to a new reaction low in here today. It is going to have to rally in a very impressive dynamic manner to question potential for additional downside. When we look at the DAX index, well, I don't think the point will not be lost on a lot of people that there is a substantial Turkish community in Germany and there are a lot of cross investments between the two countries. So we can't hold I think ignore the possibility that Germany is also going to get caught up in the problems that are currently facing Turkey. And then if we look at the European banking sector, well, again, not only has this been ranging, but it's been ranging with a downward bias since 2009, and it is also looking like a distribution rather than a consolidation in here right now. Well, if we look at the way that the world is unfolding, there are, I think, a number of very important themes that are evolving at the present moment. Well, the revolution in the energy sector, it continues to unfold, and we have the very clear new trend that the USA is an exporter and China is now the largest importer. And if we had considered that potential 20 years ago, I think we would have been laughed out of court. But the reality is that now China has got a lot to lose because it is a very significant importer of a significant number of different commodities. And what I find particularly interesting is that when we look at what happened with soybeans in here today, it was down in a very dynamic manner. And this is because there's plenty of them about. Well, the reason there's plenty of them about is because China's not buying them anymore. Now, I can't quite remember the Chinese symbol for their soybean contract. I was looking at it earlier, and what it is saying to me is that there is a short-term shortage in the market right now, and that's because it's not importing from the USA any longer. Well, that's going to start putting upward pressure on prices. And this is also an important consideration, that the trade war is not going to simply result in higher prices for manufactured goods in the West. It's going to result in higher commodity prices in China. And soybean prices are a staple in China. And not just because of cooking oil and tofu, but also because they're fed to pigs, and pork is by far the biggest staple meat. So this is, I think, a very important area to watch, because one of the things that we saw with the origin of the Arab Spring in Tunisia was that it was food riots really started to get people animated. Well, China is certainly not short of food right now, but that's on the assumption that it's going to continue to be able to source the supplies that it requires, and that is going to begin to put pressure on the administration. When we think about manufactured goods, well, that's money. When you talk about food commodities, that's existence. And that's, I think, a very important delineation. Well, China is very clear in trying to ease policy now. And SHIBOR rates had been contracting for now for about 6 weeks, and they are right back down on their lows. Well, that's a clear reflection of an easing environment within the banking sector. So the banking sector has put in a higher reaction low over the course of the last 4 weeks, and that increases the potential that we could see some a further reversion back towards the mean. At least we could give the benefit of the doubt to some additional upside, as long as it's holding the low that it put in on August 2nd. But it's all to play for in here. What we can also see is that the valuations have come in, that the historic PE for the Chinese banking sector is 6. Now, when we look at other countries where we have a dearth of governance or deteriorating governance, well, we get similar PE ratios. And this can be considered by, I think, many people that when you look at valuations, and it's always Russia and China come at the top of the list. But that also helps to, I think, highlight a value trap because of the dearth of governance. There is a lot of work to do that China needs, and what we're beginning to see the signs of is that Xi Jinping assumed power universally at the beginning of this year, and he's beginning to see some blowback from that. So that is part of the reason why the stock market has been pulling back. There's been a loss of confidence, and also the actions that have been taken to shutter the shadow banking sector have weighed particularly on the stock market. Well, they're stopping IPOs now, and that will remove some additional supply from the market. They have been cutting interest rates and removing pressure from the banking sector, so that should help to at least see the market bounce. But then the question will be asked, what next? And the big question about what next is the currency, because the renminbi is barely steady, and it's in China's interest to have a weaker currency. They don't want to support the currency because that would require raising interest rates. If they raise interest rates, then that's going to weigh on the domestic economy, and that's the last thing they want. They don't want to start buying the currency because then that would entail running down their foreign currency reserves, and they don't want to do that either. Well, they also want to get the competitive advantage from a weaker currency. So I think that this is nothing more than a distribution within the context of an ongoing downward trend. And I think we would need to see very, very clear action and not simply talking from the central bank to really confirm that we have anything other than a short-term low in here. Well, that is exactly what we need to see from Turkey. And Erdogan was in a combative mood in here today, but this definitely has climactic action. You simply don't see a currency moving by this amount on a daily basis for very long. So what that suggests is that we have a low of at least near-term significance, but accelerations are endings of undetermined duration. And what we would really need to see is some clear intervention on behalf of the central bank to begin to support this currency. But the reality is that inflation is running at about 15% and interest rates are over 17%. So what that also suggests is that we may have to see higher interest rates to create a more positive interest rate environment in real terms. But there are plenty of people would be willing to begin to think that if the seven area can hold, that 17% is probably reasonably attractive on the overnight basis. So what I think we are going to see is at least some pause and consolidation, and we are beginning to see some bargain hunting coming into the stock market. There was a substantial rally off the intraday low on the Italian, excuse me, on the Turkish stock market in here today. When we look at that on a currency adjusted basis, then we can see the clear acceleration lower in here today, but the 1,000p level starting to hold on one of these ETFs, and that also represented an area of support back in 2008. But there is a clear sense that standards of governance are deteriorating in Turkey, and it's going to require a change of some form to really reignite investor interests. But certainly, we're starting to see that a lot of the bad news is beginning to be priced in. But there is a lot of bad news. Turkey has got a debt to GDP ratio of about 55% on its foreign currency debt alone. That's before we begin to even think about all of the domestic debt. So the weakness of the currency creates some very acute problems, and not least for the banking sector. Well, if we actually look at that banking sector, it's right back on the lows from 2014 and 2011 and 2012, and it has accelerated to get down here. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we get some pause and consolidation here. But again, it is really required that we have some bullish catalyst to act as a tailwind in here right now. Now, when we look around the world on the currency front, then the Turkish lira is not the only currency that remains under pressure. The euro broke downwards in here today, and it held the decline. This is a resumption of the euro's of downtrend. It's a very clear breakdown from the most recent range, and a clear countermanding upward dynamic would be required to question potential for additional downside. If we flip that around and look at the dollar index, well, it's a clear breakout, and this raises the potential for additional upside by the dollar, and a retest of that 100-point level is, I think, probably more likely than not. Well, with the dollar breaking out, the pound has also been really quite weak, and it has declined through the 130 level this week and extended its decline. When we look at the pound versus the euro, well, we have this awfully big question about exactly what Brexit is going to entail. But supporters of a closer attitude towards Europe are beginning to muster some support. And we've had a reasonable move in favor of the pound in here today, but there's still a clear progression of lower rally highs, and that would really need to be broken in order to confirm that we're not back, or to confirm we're back in a demand-dominated environment in favor of the pound. If we look further afield, the Argentine peso was down in a dynamic manner in here today, and that's not long after it has signed an agreement with the IMF, but the market is in no mood for patience with some of these emerging market currencies that have a lot of external debt at the present moment. Well, the Indonesia, excuse me, the Indian rupee is right in the region of its lows, and the dollar was a little bit firmer against it in here today. Blessedly, India has been out of the headlines, and the rupee did rally off its low in here today. There was a news report that there has been a substantial loss by investors in Bitcoin in Gujarat, and that I think is a testament to the fact that India has been buying less gold. Well, the Nifty index was in mildly negative territory today, and it is somewhat overextended in the short term, so it is, I think, quite likely that we're going to get some consolidation, but that's probably all we're likely to get, at least is so far as the rupee continues to hold its low. Then if we look at some of the other emerging markets where weak currencies have been an issue, and the rand weakened through the 14 level in here today against the dollar, and the dollar is rallying in really quite a dramatic fashion. Well, we're starting to see that the ANC is worried about its electoral position, and they're beginning to talk about pushing through legislation of confiscating land with no compensation. Well, those kinds of moves that are extrajudicial are really not great news for investor confidence. And one of the, I think, the brightest, or perhaps the most encouraging aspect of South African governance has been the independent judiciary. But these kinds of moves are certainly not great, and this looks like a bullish consolidation in favor of the US dollar. The Brazilian real, which where we have an environment where the political parties can't get enough people together that have not been embroiled in the car wash scandal to get the confidence of people, that Lula has been Lula da Silva has been excuse me has been chosen as a political candidate for the next election, which is risible, and the real looks like it is going to weaken through this four level. One of the most impressive rallies we've seen in any of the emerging markets has been in the Mexican peso, but I would hazard that that is probably now over. And we are now starting to see that the dollar is beginning to pressure the progression of lower rally highs. So this is a broad-based dollar rally. And part of the reason for it is because when we think about the risks that are outstanding in the world, and the fact that you have pressure coming to bear on the Chinese economy, you have an uptick in geopolitical tensions, not only because of trade wars, but because of this rise of populism. Well, populism is rising for a reason. It's really quite simple, that globalization has failed too many people, and that it is very easy to lay the blame at technology and technological innovation because technology is inherently deflationary. So that has been an impact, that has been a factor. But one big hole in that argument is that when you look around the world and you look at the countries that have been most aggressive in adopting automation, they are some of the largest manufacturers. And the countries that have got the fewest robots per capita have lost to their manufacturing. Then you look at globalization, where whole areas of Northern Europe and North America have been denuded of their industries, and the entire industry has been shipped over to China, where it has created lots of employment, but it has been able to prosper because of unfair trading practices. Then you look at the industrial espionage that China is engaged in, which is unparalleled in human history, and one would have to conclude that globalization is just not working. Well, slowly but surely, people are coming around to that perspective, and that is part of the reason why we are getting so many more populist regimes coming through. But it's happening at a time when the USA is becoming energy independent. So the USA now has got less incentive to act as a stabilizing force in the international economy. And it is acting from a position of strength. So the US has done what Europe probably needs to do, and that is it has migrated from a monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus. Well, the S&P 500 got all the way back up to its high in here this week, and it has pulled back, but not in a particularly dynamic manner. Considering the decline that we've seen today in the euro and the weakness that we've seen in some of these stock markets, and I think it is worth highlighting that when you adjust the performance of stocks from to US dollars, well, the only markets that are in positive territory are Wall Street and Brazil so far this year. And I think that's rather important because the Chinese market is down in a dynamic manner. It's down 20% so far this year. And excuse me, that is not the Brazilian market. That is the Mexican market is up so far this year. Then we look at Europe and it remains under pressure. Well, if China is currently one of the epicenters of risk in the global economy, Europe is a lot more dependent on China than the USA is. So that's, I think, where we see degrees of separation from the epicenter of risk. Now, when we look at the NASDAQ 100, there's a lot of people are beginning to express anxiety about the ability of the market to continue to advance. And we've seen reports coming out from Morgan Stanley in particular saying that the bull market is over for the technology sector. Well, nobody seems to have told Apple. And Apple could be a bargaining chip in terms of the trade war, because it manufactures so many phones in China and employs so many people. And because of that fact, it has so far been immune from Chinese tariffs. Then when we look at the chart for Amazon, it was up in a rather dynamic manner yesterday, and it was only down $12 in here today. Well, it is currently almost $350 overextended relative to the trend mean, so it's not as if it's not due some pause in consolidation. Where the real concerns are starting to come through are with Facebook, which had pulled back very violently and wasn't able to hold its rally in here today, with Tesla, where you've had the CEO opining about the potential for a takeover, or sorry, for it to be taken private, to be more accurate, with no real, apparently no foundation in truth for that. That's the kind of thing that can get the attention of regulators because it is tantamount to market manipulation, and the share has given up all of its advance in here this week. One point that I think is rather important. We know that we have had a decade where a credit has been incredibly cheap, and that has helped to stoke massive bull markets. But most particularly for upstart companies like Tesla and Netflix, Lyft and Uber. And these types of companies now have valuations that are in the order of anywhere between 50 and $100 million. Billion dollars, excuse me. So the race is on for these companies to get to a big enough potential income or revenue stream so that when credit eventually dries up, that they will be positioned to dominate their respective niches. And that's potentially a success story, but needn't necessarily be. And for Tesla, their race is whether they can get to full-on production that's reliable before they run out of money. For Netflix, it's whether they can grab enough of the media market share before the cable companies and the content producers really get their act together. And for Uber, and I think it's rather important because Uber is one of the biggest employers in the USA. It employs 750,000 people. And I thought that this was a very interesting chart. It's the jobless claims index. Well, we can see that jobless claims back in early 2009 peaked around the 665,000 jobs level. But then it started to trend lower, and it continues to trend lower. And as long as it's trending lower, it would be hard to imagine that we are going to have a recession. But I think the number is quite important. We didn't have any month where the number of people, new people getting or making jobless claims was more than 665,000. In the event that Uber were to go bust, and that's not beyond the bounds of possibility, then we would see a substantial increase in unemployment, and that would cause a recession. These are, I think, rather important considerations. Well, what are the kinds of things that we should look for if that is what the risk is? Well, one thing would be high yield spreads. And there is nothing more high yield than the triple C market. And the Credit Suisse index for the triple C index has been compressing. So it was at in the region of 21% back in early 2016, and it is currently closer to 10, and it is continuing to contract. So that does not suggest that there is any real degree of credit tightness coming into the system in the USA. And then if we look at the banking sector, generally, it was a little bit weaker in here this week, but it has bounced pretty emphatically from the lower side of its range, and it's broken the progression of lower rally highs since the beginning of this year. Well, that's a very clear differentiating point between the performance of the US banks and the European banks, which have been in a pretty moribund state for much of the last decade. Then when we look at the just simple the broad aggregate of high yield spreads, it did look like it was breaking out at the beginning of July, and it has pulled all the way back in. But if we look at how that is playing out in the European market, well, we have a different story, because high yield in Europe has been trending higher now since the beginning of last year. It's certainly not surging higher, but it is trending higher. And these challenges that Europe is facing are all occurring at a point before the ECB stops buying bonds. And considering the challenges that Europe has, one would have to question whether the European region is ready for the end of the ECB's quantitative easing program. And in the event that the ECB demurs from extending the program, and I think that that is by far the most likely scenario, then that is going to put pressure on Europe. At just the same time that one of its biggest export markets in China is starting to slow down. So these are, I think, rather important characteristics. But one of the other big points is that trade wars are inflationary, and the dollar is really firm. So what I found interesting in here today was that despite the fact that the dollar was firm, the yen was even firmer. Now, the big question is really about inflation. And in Japan, you had the Nikkei pulling back by about 300 points in here today. And I was stopped out of that. But it does look like we're going to get some additional pause and consolidation. But the much bigger point is that wages are rising. And so far, those have been driven by bonuses because companies are not confident enough to, or they have been burned too often about taking on workers and then being locked into long-term contracts. So they'd much rather pay bonuses than hike wages. But the tightness in the labor market in Japan is not going away. It's probably going to be exacerbated. And the Nikkei is sustaining the move above 20,000, which is an awfully big level. If we look at the TOPIX index over the same time period, then we can see that it is consolidating in the region of the upper side of the range, and that this area around 1750 has been an area of resistance since the early 1990s. And if it can pull away from this area, well, then we're definitely in a secular bull market. I would say that the evidence we already have from the Nikkei supports the view that we are in a secular bull market for Japan. And markets like Japan and the USA need inflation, and trade wars can create inflation. So that is, I think, an important characteristic. The epicenter of risk would therefore be China because of the very large questions that are being raised about it. That if we think about what it is that is really required for the basic tenets of a good governance, then it's an independent judiciary and it is respect for minority shareholder interests and a free press. And China doesn't have any of those. In fact, India has all of them. So, from my perspective, I think India is a much better long-term bet than China, because the one thing that you want to know when you invest in an emerging market is that when it comes time to sell, that you will in fact be able to take your money out. And there is no real guarantee that that is the case with China. Whereas there is no impediment to doing that with India. And therefore, when we also look at the additional points with China, that you have a war going on in terms of the freedom of expression and the freedom of association, and you have an autocratic dictator that has taken over. I've been doing a lot of reading about fascism, and when you look at the definition of fascism, both Russia and China fit very clearly into that mold. What is very clear is that the further you get to the extremes, or you get away from the middle, that the difference between very sharp right wing and very sharp left wing is very, very small indeed. That it's almost like a continuum, that rather than you thinking about it being the sharp left and the sharp right, but rather it's a circle, and that the sharp left and the sharp right meet at the back of the circle. Fascism was certainly included corporatism, and China has adopted corporatism. There is the Genesis myth and the myth of resurgence, where China is going to retake its position as the preeminent global economy. And then there is the feeling that democracy is a failed ideology, and that it is only right and proper that communism and with Chinese characteristics takes over, which in any other definition is in fact fascism. Fascists become particularly dangerous when they start to have international ambitions, and China is exhibiting those international ambitions already. The Belt and Road scheme is code for international expansion. If Napoleon said that an army marches on its feet, but it needs to march on a road, and that would certainly be the modus operandi for the Belt and Road system. Then we also look at the fact that there are 1 million people that have been incarcerated in Xinjiang for no other reason than the fact that that they're Muslim, so or that they are not of the Han minority nationality. The fact that you have increasing racism where black people can no longer check into hotels in Guangzhou, that's also an additional factor here that supports the view that the totalitarian regime and increasing dictatorial attributes of Xi Jinping are fascist in nature. And That's a really quite considerable challenge. When we think about the international order and the fact that the globalization and the global logistics network that's been set up over the last 40 years has prospered because of a willingness to look past differences. But those differences are not narrowing. There was a very clear belief that by adopting globalization, that we would be in turn see that rising standards of living would allow liberalism to flourish, and that simply has not occurred. And that is, I think, a very large consideration, that there has been a complete denuding of the manufacturing sectors of Europe and North America, and those people have got nothing in return. And now they're voting with their feet. And what that suggests is that we're going to have a much more volatile environment. We went decades without having to worry about the political environment, and now there's hardly a day goes by that it doesn't have some effect on the investment markets. So the rise of populism is a very clear and dynamic theme, and it is likely to have a long-term impact on the markets. And the bigger question is what kind of influence it's going to have on the bond markets. US 10-year Treasury yields continue to pause around the 3% level. And if they sustain a move back below the trend mean, well, then we would have to conclude that we're going to have a longer base formation development. The reality is that the yield has been trending lower since 1980, and the bond prices tend to do best when people are worried about the economy. And I'm starting to see evidence of people expressing anxiety. We don't really have a great deal of evidence that there's a lot of anxiety being expressed in the primary stock market indices for Wall Street right now, but there's anxiety being expressed just about everywhere else, and there is the potential that that could result in a medium-term correction for Wall Street, while other markets potentially experience a sharper reaction. Well, eventually the USA is going to have a recession, but probably not before, and almost definitely not before, we see the yield curve invert. And the yield curve did contract further in here today. It's down to less than 27 basis points right now. Well, it's not until we see it going negative that banks stop making money, and that does then has a knock-on effect on the availability of credit. And generally speaking, that creates a lead indicator for a recession of anything from 6 months to 18 months. Well, that takes us into at least next year, if not even 2020. So this is likely to be the longest expansion in US history. We also know that the high yield spread has not been contracting and that unemployment is still low and oil prices are not surging higher. In fact, when we look at the oil price in nominal terms, then Brent crude has been pulling back over the course of the last 3 weeks. It's almost unwound all of its oversold condition, excuse me, overbought condition relative to the trend mean, and we started to see just some evidence of support starting to come back in here at the lower side of the range in here today. If oil prices were surging higher, well, then that would be a cause for alarm. And considering the pressure that is coming to bear on the Venezuelan economy, well, then there is the potential that they could drop out even further from supplying oil to the global economy. When we think about what are the bullish considerations for the market, well, we know that the energy revolution is ongoing, that oil is a very big and important commodity for the global economy, there are revolutions going on in terms of transportation, and that there are battery technologies that are improving all the time. What we have seen in terms of those battery technologies has been some clear evolution over the course of the last year, where Tesla has employed the 8-to-1-to-1 battery mixtures, which is using less cobalt, and cobalt prices have contracted violently over the last 7 or 8 weeks. But nickel is increasingly being used in more of, while they are using less cobalt, and we're seeing initial evidence that nickel prices are finding support in the region of the trend mean. Well, what this suggests to me is that we are in a period of consolidation for some of these commodities, but that the longer term view is that we're going to have more batteries on the market. And part of the reason for that is because an increasingly large number of auto manufacturers are admitting to emissions cheating, and their only way to avoid massive fines is going to be to invest heavily in battery-driven cars. So we're going to see a lot more battery-driven cars on the road for that reason alone, regardless of what we have, what benefits we get in terms of improving battery chemistries. And that's likely to drive a whole innovation cycle on its own. But what we have at the moment is rapid pace of technological innovation, not just in one sector, but in many. And it's particularly the case in biotechnology, where both the cost of genetic sequencing is declining rapidly. The speed with which genetic editing can take place as a result of CRISPR is accelerating. And that is holding out the prospect for a real and substantive gain in terms of curing very intransigent diseases like cancer. And that's going to massively improve productivity growth. In normal circumstances, that alone would help to drive a secular bull market. Well, we still have the rise of the global consumer. Now, the fact that we do have more tensions in terms of global trade is a headwind to some of those companies. But the reality is that we have literally hundreds of billions of new consumers entering the global economy every year, and where the real population growth is coming from is from countries that are outside China, not so much in China. So it's primarily Africa and India, where you have large, very, very large populations of young people. And their demand for just about everything is likely to continue to stoke the demand growth for just about everything. So those are the kinds of themes that can help to animate the bull market. And that's on top of the fact that the USA is going to be energy independent within the next couple of years. Well, the strength of the dollar and the relative pressure that that's putting on gold is resulting on the Dow gold ratio beginning to accelerate higher, and it went through 20 in here this week. Well, gold prices have been under pressure. That's despite the fact that we have seen people in Turkey and in Venezuela, Argentina, and Iran all buying gold, but that hasn't been enough to move the price when denominated in US dollars, because the dollar has been particularly firm. Well, gold prices are all the way back down to $1,200. When we look at this on a weekly basis, well, then the trend that's been coming up since the beginning of 2016 has been broken, and there is a short-term oversold condition now evident. So there is ample potential for a bounce in here, but there's no evidence that it started just yet. And in the event that $1,200 is taken out, well, that's going to hold out the prospect that the lows from early 2016 are re-challenged. Well, there was a very clear rounding characteristic evident in gold from 2013 onwards, and that is now certainly being challenged. gold is going to have to rally and do so in a dynamic manner to be, even begin to reassert the medium-term bullish prognostication. This is still a market that is under pressure. But I think a lot of that has to do with the relative strength of the dollar in this environment. Silver prices have been also under pressure, but they've been more range-bound of late than gold. And they are pausing around this $15 area, which has been an area of support for at least the last 2 years. But again, it has got a lot of work to do in order to really reignite investor interest. Platinum prices have paused around the $800 area, and it's a pretty similar story. Well, gold miners have pretty much stopped investing in new supply, and that has, I think, helped to improve their finances. But when gold is selling off in such an aggressive manner, then that is going to put pressure on the gold mining sector. And it is coming right back down to test the lows that we saw at the beginning of 2017. When we look at the holdings of the ETF investors, well, the index is now back below the trend mean. So this is exactly where it needs to find support if the upward trend to ETF holdings of gold is going to remain in an upward bias. There's been a lot of commentary recently about the role of ETFs and the momentum-driven nature of market cap indices. Well, when you buy the index and it's a market cap weighted index, well, you necessarily end up with a big weighting in the companies that have done best. There has been a lot of crowing or Schadenfreude in the mutual fund in the industry because they have largely sidestepped the FANG stocks. They have been underweight the FANG stocks, so their loss of uptrend or I guess relative strength in the short term has helped the dismal performance of some of the mutual fund managers somewhat. But I really think that we're just not there yet in terms of concluding that we're on at the dawn of a tech wreck. That the US economy is still expanding and the stock market is still trending in a reasonably consistent manner. The fact that Turkey was so far off the low in terms of the stock market and here today would suggest that it is a pretty climactic action that we've just seen. It doesn't mean that the crisis is over, but the bigger question is how much of a feedback loop there's going to be into the wider economy. Certainly, Turkey has got a lot of debt, but this, I think, is a question that's going to be explored by investors over the course of the next few weeks and months. And I think it is only a matter of time before the Turkish administration gets some sense of reality when they look at what the kinds of options they have available to them are. We've already seen in Europe that within the Eurozone, the Italian bond yield has first step above the base characteristics. It looks more likely than not that we are going to see additional upside in Italian yields. But this is the outlier, that by and large, European bond yields have been really quite constrained, and that Germany in particular has been benefiting from a safe haven status, and the yield was tighter in here today in a dynamic manner. So that yield is now contracting from the trend mean. There is the realistic possibility that the Bund will go back down and test the 0% bound. And that is, I think, more a reflection of just how much angst that investors have with regard to Europe and Turkey and the knock-on effects from China than any other factor. When we think about where the potential for problems is, well, a lot of people have been conditioned to expect a crash on Wall Street because we've had one in 2000 and we had one in 2007. But when we look at the underperformance that we're seeing in Europe and the underperformance we're seeing in China, well, we would have to conclude that that's where the risk is, that the next problem could evolve outside of the USA. That doesn't mean that there isn't going to be blowback, that there might also be some contagion selling, but we know that it is the markets where you have a greater degree of separation from the epicenter of risk that rebound first. And realistically, when we look at Facebook and Google and Amazon, how much business do they have in China? Almost, well, in fact, none at all. These are, I think, very important characteristics for the leaders in this advance overall. Well, we also then have the fact that we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. And it is, generally speaking, cyclical shares do best. And by and large, the technology sector is cyclical. Well, the adoption of the subscription business model has made them considerably less so. It has helped to iron out their cash flows, and that has helped to justify their higher valuations. I think that the biggest risk is more in the private companies that don't make any money than in the big technology companies that have got very strong cash flows, and indeed a lot of them have no debt, most particularly Facebook. That they are in a process of consolidation, but they're unlikely to disappear. Whereas the companies like Tesla and Uber could disappear if they can't get to the critical mass necessary for survival when credit conditions do tighten. So I think there is a lot of things to consider, but by and large, I think that Wall Street is likely to continue to attract investor interest as a safe haven, considering the challenges that are existing everywhere else. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.